As it was said, I've been working on documenting crimes in Iraq and Syria, including but not only crimes said to be committed by ISIS since 2011 with the UN Commission of Inquiry, the IIIM, most recently with UNITAD in Iraq, and then I also do a bit of work with NGOs on the ground, doing training them on documenting these crimes. I'm going to speak to you a little bit about the Yazidis and ISIS's crimes against the Yazidis and some of the analysis that I was a part of when I was at the Commission of Inquiry. I was the lead investigator and then drafter of the report, June 2016 report, They Came to Destroy ISIS Crimes Against the Yazidis, which found that ISIS was committing crimes of crimes against humanity and genocide against this religious minority. But I also want to use it as a jumping point, really, to discuss the more pragmatic difficulties in documenting ISIS crimes and the work of working on criminal accountability, trying to move from the stage of actually documenting the crimes, where there's actually not a huge amount of disagreement over what crimes have been committed, partly because ISIS is quite unique in that it doesn't seek to reframe or mitigate its crimes. It doesn't seek to put forward a version, an alternative version of events of them being attacked, or these or them attacking armed groups within the civilian population, as we've seen, or using the language of terrorism, which we've seen in the case of, like, for example, the Syrian government and now currently Turkey. So that does make actually making the determination of crimes slightly easier, because they're very transparent about what their intent is and also what they're doing on the ground. On the other hand, we haven't really seen any successful cases in relation to ISIS crimes coming up. They're burbling up within national jurisdictions with the path of international justice closed. So I want to spend a little time speaking about the path from deciding, knowing what the crime is, to actually trying to get a viable case dossier together. And then, of course, that will feed into a little bit about what's in the news this week in relation to Turkey's attacks into northern Syria and possibility and increasing likelihood that some of the camps which may hold perpetrators or people complicit with these crimes will be opened, and that they will not be, they will then be kind of lost to the wind, at least for a while. So I'm just going to... So just to start, I know that if you're interested in this, you may well have been following ISIS's territorial expansion and collapse, but I just want to go over it just so that everyone is on the same page when we start. This really here was ISIS's area of control. They reached peak area of control in around September, October of 2014, when they pushed down their front line southwards, almost to north of Baghdad, reaching within 60 kilometers north of Baghdad. They had been present in Syria since 2013, when in fact they had pushed out other armed groups from their capital, Raqqa, Raqqa being the de facto Syrian capital of ISIS. In the June 9th, 10th of 2014, they attacked Mosul, and to the great surprise of very many people, the army in Mosul collapsed there very quickly, and there was under quite a small force of ISIS fighters, and ISIS took over the Mosul area. When they did so, they went from being a group which was reliant on outside funding and fundraising, including from individuals, and for example, in the Gulf and other kind of financial trails, to being largely financially independent and militarily well-equipped as they opened up the Mosul banks and also got access to a huge amount of weaponry from there. And that really changed the dynamic for them, and it's been quite a... It created other issues in terms of how to trace any kind of state liability to a non-state actor, which has become very state-like, but also very independent, with actually quite a strong state-like apparatus, including a budgeting plan and development plan. Literally started 3 minutes ago, so it's fine. So. By the end of June 2014, we had a situation where ISIS is in Raqqa, which is the Syrian capital. ISIS is in Mosul, which is their Iraqi de facto capital. And in between the two capitals is this area called Sinjar. Sinjar is a area about 12 kilometers inside Iraq from the Iraqi-Syrian border. It is, as we'll see in later maps, cut through the heart by a mountain range called Mount Sinjar, which is plateaued on top. It is home to a variety of was home to a variety of religious and ethnic groups, including Yazidis, but also Sunni Muslims, Kurds, Sunni Kurds. There's a speckle of Christians, although they mainly were in the Nineveh Plains. The Yazidis are quite a significant part of the population of Sinjar. Until actually this happened, I had not come across the Yazidis at all, which is not surprising. Most people will not have. In the world, they number probably only 1 million, although there are no firm estimates. Their largest community is in the Sinjar area. And again, there have been no census taken. The last census was under the Saddam Hussein government in the early 90s and put them at around 300,000 to 350,000 then. It's estimated that there were probably about just under half a million Yazidis in that area at the time of the attack. So on the 2nd of August, the attack took place in the early morning of the 3rd of August. On the 2nd of August, you had all the Yazidis there. By the 5th of August, there were no free Yazidis in the Sinjar area. They'd either fled, been killed, or were encircled by ISIS at that time. It was only a matter of time that the Yazidis were going to be attacked. ISIS is a Salafi jihadist group, which adheres to what it perceives to be a very purist form of Islam, essentially taking Islam to the 7th century, although I think there's plenty to quibble with that on, because there is some suggestion. Der Spiegel did a really interesting article around the overlap between Ba'athist regimes and former Saddam Hussein regime operatives and the upper echelons of ISIS, which is actually one of the reasons why people think they were so successful at state building and, for example, running services in Mosul. In a recent survey of Mosul, many of the residents, although they suffered greatly under ISIS, did say that they thought actually they were much better at governing than the Iraqi government, the current Iraqi government, which is also so to say that in terms of security, the security was higher, but also the corruption corruption was much less. One man who sold chickens on the side of the road had said that when he was selling chickens, someone said, "Oh, I want that chicken," and he killed the chicken and prepared it for them, and then said, "Oh, I only have half the money, so you've just got to take it now." And he said before he wouldn't go and complain to the police about it because the cost of paying the bribe would actually be the cost than the more chicken. But under ISIS, of course, the matter was dealt with quite quickly, and it was only even the threat of reporting it to ISIS would have meant that he would have got his money. So the Yazidis are a religious minority. It's unclear. They appear in the historical record in the 12th century, and the record of persecution against them appears in the record from the 13th century. They're thought to be one of the world's oldest religions. They are monotheistic, as they will take pains to tell you every time you interview someone who is Yazidi. I think the reality suggests that they're originally polytheistic and very nature-based religion, heavily influenced by surrounding religions at the time of their birth, including Zoroastrianism. But over the years, they have taken in elements of other religions, including monotheistic religions, in order to survive. Thanks, Samir, how are you doing? They've taken in other elements, so they have what Christians would consider to be a baptism ceremony. They pray several times a day, but they still have very nature-infused and huge amounts of respect for nature and religion. They are also seen very generally to... they suffer a prejudice of being seen as devil worshippers, and that's for a variety of reasons, which if you look at their religion, they have a board of seven angels. The chief angel is the peacock angel Malik Taus, who is, if you view it through a Judeo-Christian lens, the story of Malik Taus very much sounds like an angel who fell from heaven to earth, who was cast out of heaven. That's not how the Yazidis see him. And of course, their story, they would say, predates the story of Lucifer being kicked out of heaven. But nevertheless, this idea of the Yazidis, the people who worship the devil, has persisted. And it's not something that has come from ISIS. I was in Iraq in 2013, about a year before ISIS took Mosul. And I remember driving just along the side of Mosul at the time, which was safe. And the driver who was with me was a Christian Arab guy, lovely. He said, "Do you see those villages over there?" And I said, "Yes." He goes, "The people in those villages worship the devil." So it's one of the things I also want to emphasize as we go through the presentation, is that it's important not to view ISIS as some kind of aberration that just landed on Iraq and Syria out of nowhere. A lot of what they, a lot of the crimes that they did and their attitudes towards particular religious minorities are founded within existing bigotries and prejudice, and were part of a society which was already quite tolerant of violence against these particular communities. So when we talk about crimes, I think it's also important to look at how the existing cultural scaffolding of the society meant that it was people were more less willing to stand up, or maybe less willing to help when they could have helped. So we get to the point of ISIS attack. We have this religious minority. They keep to themselves. They don't intermarry, in part because for the child to be Yazidi, both parents have to be Yazidi. It's also a means of protection, so they're not accused of trying to convert members of other religions, and so it also makes them less vulnerable to attack. So they're sitting in their villages around Mount Sinjar, about maybe 450,000 of them, and about 80 villages scattered across the mountain. Most villages are either Yazidi or Kurdish or Arab. There's a backstory around the Arabization of the region under Saddam Hussein, which is relevant, but is probably a bit too deep a dive for this particular lecture, but I'm happy to go into it in the questions. In the early hours of the 3rd of August, ISIS fighters come out of their bases in both Iraq and in Syria. There are suggestions that although the policy and the decisions were made in Mosul, that the operation center for this particular attack was in Tel Afar, with a forward operating base in Baj, which is the town, Arab town just to the south of the Sinjar region. Baj is a town which I think is a very good encapsulation of what ISIS is and how it plays into Iraq. Because before ISIS, Baj was actually a hotspot for Al-Qaeda activity in 2005-2006. And prior to that, in the Saddam Hussein regime, it was one of the most powerful roots of the Ba'ath party inside Iraq. So again, it's not really a case of looking at ISIS as an object, as like a block of wood that landed in Iraq. It's kind of, I would think of ISIS almost as a transparent liquid, whereas if you look down into ISIS, you'll see beneath it layers of points of conflict, of power and conflict inside Iraq. And in many ways, I think of ISIS, if you think of the double helix of the DNA, one limb of the helix, that's probably not the right word, but whatever, one of the spiraling things down in the DNA is, of course, this idea of Salafi jihadi interpretations of Islam. And I think that's really how what seeped into the public's consciousness about ISIS. That's how we see them, this kind of group that's trying to get back to the 7th century and trying to institute the Hud punishments and so on, amputations and beheadings. But actually, the other part of ISIS's DNA is of a Sunni power movement. And it's very difficult to divorce those two things. And I think there has been unwillingness to recognize the fact that ISIS is also born out of continual efforts to repair the humiliation of the Sunnis following the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime. And so separating ISIS from the fall of the Ba'ath party in particular is very, very difficult, but that is something that hasn't been reckoned with as much in the discussions. As ISIS moves into Sinjar, they mainly move through the south again, through Baj, which is now continues to be a hotspot of ISIS activity even to this day. They are met with no resistance from any of the defensive forces within the Sinjar region. At that point in time, Sinjar is in a disputed area between the Iraq central government and the Kurdish regional government, but it is protected by the Peshmerga, who are generally quite well regarded, although I would argue not as well regarded as the SDF currently under attack in northern Syria. The Peshmerga are a force of the KDP, the Iraqi Kurdish government. Don't worry, you're not disturbing me. I work in Iraq, so like lots of things happen. People walking in that room doesn't bother me. So if people need to get coffee or go to the bathroom, it's fine. You're not gonna make me stumble. The Peshmerga forces were based all around the Sinjar region, and that was for good reason because ISIS had taken over Mosul in June 2014. There had been continued small scale attacks along the edges of the Sinjar region. It would not have been a surprise to anyone that the Sinjar region had been attacked if you had been in the area, given who lived in the Sinjar region and the ideology that ISIS set forth. When ISIS attacked, the Peshmerga were present. There were checkpoints all across the region. In the village of Kocho, which you probably have heard most of if you've been following this, because Nadia Murad is from Kocho, who's the Nobel Peace Prize winner last year, there was actually a huge contingent based in the school, which would later become briefly a holding site. The Peshmerga, for reasons which are still very unclear, withdrew from Sinjar. They pulled their men out of Sinjar, but they did so without informing anyone that they were leaving. So for a lot of Yazidis, some of those who saw them pull out fled, but for a lot of people, this was in the middle of the night, they didn't even know that the checkpoints were empty. So they sat in their homes to decide, like, well, should we run? We're hearing fighting, we're getting calls. They're like, well, we don't know which roads are open, we don't know who's where. Let's stay here because we have a defensive shield around us, not realizing that in many places ISIS was simply walking through empty checkpoints. It continues to have divided the Yazidi community from the KDP, Kurdish government, to this day. The Kurdish government had continued to speak about having an inquiry. That doesn't seem to have happened, or if there has been one, it hasn't been a public inquiry. And so also that is one of the discussions around, although I'm speaking much more about criminal accountability, it is one of the questions about broader reaches of transitional justice, because the issue of truth-telling and trying to find out what happened in the early hours of the 3rd of August, why the Peshmerga left, why it wasn't communicated to everyone, is still very much an open and quite raw question. And the assumption of the Yazidi community, which I think is not unreasonable, is that they simply weren't valued enough to tell. They were so marginalized and so viewed as othered anyway that there wasn't as much of an attempt to protect them as they would have been if they, for example, had been Kurdish Muslim. In some areas, not very many local Yazidi men took up arms, small fire weapons. Most people in that area, as I mentioned, Iraq, there's a ton of small arms everywhere. There was no way they were ever going to fight off ISIS, given the weaponry ISIS was coming in. They were simply trying to give people some time, their families some time to escape. If we think about the time of the ISIS attack, I say it's best to kind of divide these Yazidis into three groups, depending on what happened to them. This is Sinjar here, this is Syria, this is Mount Sinjar. You have Yazidi villages on all sides, and you have Baj, which is here to the south. If you divide the Yazidis into three groups, the first group immediately is based close enough to the border that they go either into Syria or into Iraqi Kurdistan and immediately into IDP camps or with relatives into urban shelters. And they flee in advance of ISIS and are safe. Another group flee to Mount Sinjar. Mount Sinjar is in the heart of the Sinjar region. It also has a particular meaning to the Yazidi community. The Yazidis, as I said, have been historically persecuted. They often refer to 74 genocides. They don't use genocide in a particularly legal term, but it's quite clear that they have been attacked on many, many occasions. The largest, there's still to this day, the most lethal bombing in Iraq was the 2007 bombing of Yazidi communities in Qataniya and Sabal Sheikha, which is quite saying something given Iraq's history of bombings. Until 2014, it was also the largest death count in any one attack. It was only overtaken by the ISIS attack on Camp Spiker and their execution of Iraqi army soldiers in Camp Spiker in 2014. In the 1800s, or in 1834, Mount Sinjar had been a point of refuge for the Yazidis when they were attacked by the Turks during that time. At various points in their history, they had fled to Mount Sinjar, where one of the oldest Yazidi temples was based, for safety. And so they did in August 2014, those of them that were close enough to reach Mount Sinjar. It's August 2014 in Iraq. It's over 50 degrees. I don't know if anyone's been in Iraq for that temperature. There is no water. There are no trees. It's an arid plain on the top. There are no trees. There's no water sources once you reach a certain height. They fled to the top and ISIS besieged them, particularly around the areas of water sources. So you had thousands of Yazidis on top there. They were trapped there for about 10 to 14 days. Hundreds of them died on the mountains, mainly elderly and very young children. Largely of dehydration. It's at this point, and it's really, if you saw any of the footage from August 2014, what you will have seen is footage of people fleeing to the mountains. This is the statement of the White House on August 7th, so only 3 days after the attack began under the Obama White House. It really bears the mark, actually, of Samantha Power, who I believe is going to be speaking in Oxford on the 4th of November, perhaps? Or maybe that. She's going to be around anyway on the 4th of November. And she wrote this book called The Problem from Hell about American policy and genocide. And you can see very carefully here the language from the Genocide Convention. We can act carefully and responsibly to prevent a potential act of genocide, really calling upon the duty to prevent with a serious risk of genocide in a way that you don't often see in public statements. But here we have very much a focus on the mountain and the authorization of targeted airstrikes, starting American and Iraqi airstrikes into northern Iraq, including strikes around Erbil, where ISIS had advanced to, but also around the base of Mount Sinjar, pushing back ISIS and allowing the Syrian Kurdish forces to come in and fight from the ground. Now, the Peshmerga have largely fallen back, and it is the Syrian Kurds, at that time called the YPG, now called the SDF, for reasons which, again, we don't need to go into, but they then fight through and open a humanitarian corridor, which is about 12 kilometers long and 3 kilometers wide, between the border Syria, the Hasaka region, and the mountain, the Shaladi region and the mountain. And using that, coupled with Iraqi and American airstrikes, they manage to evacuate the Yazidis. Thousands of Yazidis are taken off the mountain into Syria. Some of them remain in Syria, but the majority of them join their former community members who escaped earlier in IDP camps and in houses and urban centers, mainly in Iraqi Kurdistan, mainly in the Duhok region. These people have obviously been subjected to crimes. We'll speak about that later. So now you have those two groups. And the third group, of course, is the people who are left on the ground, who either didn't flee in time, didn't get to the mountain in time, or stayed in their homes, or were caught trying to flee. So here we're looking, if we go back, we see it's actually quite a big area with these Yazidi communities on both sides of this mountain range here, which is it's a tremendously actually large area. One of the things that was noticeable about the attack when we started to document what was happening is I would interview a lot of survivors, mainly women, because it was actually largely women who tended to survive if they'd come into contact with ISIS. And one of the things, it was very much like speaking to someone on a conveyor belt, because the people, even if they came from the north side of the mountain, the south side of the mountain, from Sinjar town versus a rural village, they all had very, very similar experiences of what happened once they came into contact with ISIS. So you saw very clearly a set pattern of events and atrocities, including where things happen, the sequence in which happened. So planning is not an element of genocide, but it is something to look at, inferring the intent and looking at just the architecture of criminality that ISIS produced. It's important to know that this is not mob violence. This was something that required a huge amount of resources from ISIS to attack from both sides of the mountain, to liaise, to set up primary holding sites, and then secondary holding sites, some of which held thousands of women and children before they were dispersed around its caliphate. So I'm going to go through really quickly what happened to different Yazidis in this attack. And I think it's really important because I think sometimes when we discuss crimes that are committed, not only by ISIS, but even, for example, by the Syrian government in relation to its behavior inside Syrian government detention centers, there's a tendency to put all victims as a kind of great big lump of victims in a basket. But in fact, what we saw is that the kind of crimes and the strategies of criminality that were pursued really differ depending on the gender of the victims, but also the age of the victims. And those two rubrics are really important. And I think if you're doing an analysis and you're not taking an age disaggregated analysis or a gender sensitive analysis, that you really lose an understanding of how crimes are designed and committed and are committed differently to use cultural mores and perceptions of what a victim is against them. So the way in which, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, we'll see that the way in which ISIS attacked female Yazidi women and girls was actually meant to be incredibly destructive to the community, even without killing them. And also why men are generally tend to be prioritized for killing, as we've seen in most conflicts. We'll start with the men, because the men were subject to the most immediate violations by ISIS. This is in italics, there are some of the publicly released sections of the statements that I took with the commission. What we saw, as you generally see in situations of mass atrocity, not only genocide, is that there was an immediate separation of the sexes. You had men and older boys, usually in this case boys over 13. ISIS checked for that in different ways, from underarm hair to looking at teeth, to just kind of looking at height, and were taken away, and they were largely executed almost immediately. In Kocho village, where Nadia Murad is from, they executed about 550 men and boys in August 2014. They also executed those who were found with weapons immediately. The issue of converting to Islam is a bit more complicated, because in some instances, people were given a chance to convert. In some instances, they were not. In most instances, they were not. There were two mass killings. As I said, we've exhumed. This year, we've been working to exhume. I say exhume, but actually the technical term is excavate mass graves in Kocho. And those are being identified as also part of a more transitional justice process around right to know. And we're hoping to get the first batch of remains to families that have given DNA and be able to identify them within before the end of the year. For a small group who were converted, they then entered into kind of a twilight state, because they had accepted Islam, they were not executed immediately, but ISIS really didn't understand what to do with Yazidis who'd converted to Islam particularly, because on one hand they were being forced to go to mosque and forced to pray, the women were covering. On the other hand, they were put into several villages, not allowed to leave those villages. They were being made to take place in forced labor, often very gendered forced labor, men doing construction and checking sheep, women kind of doing housework and so on. There came a point when they decided these conversions were fake, and that seemed to coincide with the advance of Kurdish forces, both Peshmerga and SDF, into ISIS territory. And they basically said, "You're the reason we're losing. We're not losing because we're terrible fighters. We're losing because somehow you're getting secret messages and giving them information." So in the spring of 2014, we documented from the women who were in those villages and who survived, that they took everyone out of the villages, separated the men and boys, took the women away, and since then we haven't heard from the men and boys. It is possible that Yazidis did continue to live, having said they had converted inside ISIS, but that hasn't really appeared to be the case, and it's generally felt that it's likely that those men and boys were executed around the spring of 2015. Yazidi women and girls. If you know about these Yazidis, it will probably be because of the term sexual slavery. I personally don't really like the term sex slave. These Yazidi communities try to stop people from using it. There hasn't been very much of an attempt to link an analysis of why sexual violence was used in this particular way against this particular people. But it's and also, to be fair, sexual violence also, we don't want it to eclipse the fact that women and girls suffered a wide range of violence, of what sexual violence was a part, but it was only one part. Women and girls were separated from men and boys. The men and boys were largely, older boys were largely executed. The women and girls generally tended to be taken to a primary holding site within the first 24 hours of capture. And there were different primary holding sites outside in different areas. So for Kocho village, a primary holding site was a place called Solar Technical Institute, which was about 15 minutes drive away. In Sinjar town, it was a PUK office, or KDP office. They used to hold them temporarily. Once they grouped enough of them, they brought in buses and cars, sometimes used these own cars, and took them to the secondary, much larger holding sites, of which there were fewer of them. And so you found groupings there. In Mosul, for example, they used a wedding hall called Galaxy. They used some villages in Al Arabi neighborhood. They used secondary schools in Mosul and Tel Afar. And they used Badouche prison just outside of Mosul, which held thousands, and which also had been the scene of an attack in June 2014, with everyone who wasn't Sunni Muslim executed, including a large number of Shias and Yazidis as well. We saw a few reports of the mass killing of older women. For example, in Kocho, Nadia Murad's mother, for example, would have been separated. Women who were over the age of childbearing were taken away and executed, and that mass grave has been found and is currently being excavated. That didn't happen at all sites. One of the things that was, I hesitate to use the word interesting, but it is actually legally quite interesting, was that at the holding sites, you had sometimes hundreds of and sometimes thousands, in the case of Badoosh, women and girls, with very few guards around them. And most of the guards were the lowest level of ISIS guards, meaning that they were probably anywhere between 18 to 27 years old. And yet we saw very few indications of people being raped at the holding sites. It did happen, but when it happened, it was very hidden by the guards from the other guards. And it's also, it goes to show in some ways, one, the grip that ISIS had over all members of its forces, but also this idea very quickly of how they move from seeing the women as women and girls, as people, as to being chattel. Because ISIS then viewed them as spoils of war, as property, and was pricing them. And of course, part of the price relied on them, for example, being virgins if they weren't married, or not having been used by many men. This is how the thinking went. And in the same way as if someone gave you their car to keep in your driveway and you wouldn't go out and wreck it, that was in some ways the thinking behind why you didn't see this preying on women who were unarmed. I'm going to take you to now just some of the sections. You can read it while I'm speaking because they're a bit longer, the excerpts. These are two excerpts of women. Women and girls were generally sold in three ways. They were sold in organized slave markets, which went through a very bureaucratic procedure where you actually had to register to attend the slave market. You had to submit your bids in sealed envelopes sometimes. A lot of the time you had just people coming in and purchasing people at the holding sites, just kind of, and that was largely people who were a bit higher up in ISIS. You also had men who were, guess what you would call wholesalers. They would go they would come from regions that didn't have a slave market in them. They would go and essentially buy a group of women and then sell them individually in their areas. And then you also had a widespread use of at this app. Which name I always forget. Is it Telegraph or Telegram?
Telegram.
I always get that wrong. The Telegram app, where you had ISIS. You still actually have ISIS-only channels on Telegram. They've actually become much more active in the last week, since in a response to the opportunities created by the Turkey's invasion into northern Syria. But the Telegram app was very instrumental, and they had a series of online marketing of women, posting photos of women and discussing prices. This is one woman, the first one is one woman I interviewed. She'd been sold 15 times in a year and a half from ISIS. She said, you're like, oh, it's this woman, the second one. You're like a sheep and I have bought you. When women were taken into a process of sexual enslavement, of course, they suffered tremendous, sustained sexual violence, often very brutal. But they were often also beaten. They were forced to labor inside fighters' homes. They were kept in conditions with very little medical care, often very little food, very little heat in winter. And so there was a wide range of a wide range of violations that they suffered. It was very much a system of property, and I'll give an example of what happened in one of the interviews, which is very hard to understand, I think, sitting in this room or in any average room, to understand what it means to treat someone as property in real life. But I was interviewing this woman, and her fighter owner had gone off to battle, and so he had given her care of her to his friend, who was also another ISIS fighter from the same area. And of course he had to do that because in any case in ISIS-controlled territory, no woman can walk alone in the street to go and get food or whatever else. So you would need to have someone who was male with you in order to survive, no matter who you were, whether you're a Yazidi or a Sunni woman. Sunni women also being victims of forced marriages in ISIS-controlled territory. Also, Yazidi women generally weren't given the covering because it helped them not to escape. Because once you got into the street dressed like this, you would immediately be picked up. So Yazidi women generally weren't covered and they were kept locked inside homes. So he goes off to fight. He gives this woman to his colleague in ISIS. And then he dies. The fighter owner is killed. He gets blown up in an airstrike. He dies in battle somehow. She doesn't know. And so the question was, well, what happened to you? And in my head, obviously you're asking open-ended questions, so, but in my head I was thinking, well, this guy must have kept her, this guy. And she said, I said, so what happened next? She went, well, he died without a will, and so he was intestate, and so my ownership reverted back to the Islamic State. And so the fighter that I was with, who was taking care of me, who was my guardian, essentially, took me to the local wali and said, oh, you know, her owner has died, the Islamic State has to resell her because you own her now. And the Islamic State then gave the person who returned her first option of buying her. So it was a very, very archaic system of it. The other thing I would say is, like, when we're discussing it, we have to distinguish between Islamic State and Islamic State fighters. Islamic State did the first sale. In the same way, if you go to a car dealership, the car dealership will... I'm sorry, it's very upsetting, I think, to speak about people in this, but I think to understand what ISIS was doing, you have to kind of invest in understanding what it means to treat someone like property. But in the same way, if you buy a car from a car dealership, the car dealership makes the money in the first sale, but if you then sell it on and on, they don't make any money. So this was never really a source of funds for ISIS. There's been some, they received very little money compared to the fact they were making millions on oil and antiquities. This was really done something for an ideological purpose around Yazidis. So we look at young children held with Yazidi women, who are generally being overlooked. A lot of children, if they were under the age of 7 if they were a boy, or under the age of 9 if they were a girl, were kept with their mothers and sold as packages throughout the ISIS caliphate until the children reached those ages, in which case the boys were then taken from their mothers and sent to cub camps, and the girls were then sold into the system of sexual enslavement as a separate unit. Often you saw children suffering beatings from their ISIS fighters' family. They received very little food and water. They were held in the same poor conditions as their mother. The older ones were certainly very aware of the fact the mother was being sexually abused. And there's also been a couple instances of children being killed. There's one famous incident of this woman who goes under the pseudonym of Maha, and she's used that in a number of interviews, so it's not difficult to track her. And she tells this very story at the same time. She tried to escape once and was gang rape and punishment, and the second time she tried to escape, her fight owner killed two of her children. So we've seen that as well. The level of trauma amongst young Yazidi children is quite immense. There have been not as many services to deal with that trauma. I'm now really concerned I'm now traumatizing the entire room through this work. We'll get more to the legal stuff. I mean, if you work in international criminal law, then of course you deal with those situations, and then we can talk about the ways in which if you work in this full time, you are trained to kind of manage how you work on these issues. But I'm very sorry if I'm upsetting anybody in the room. So boys aged 7 and above were taken from their mothers and sent to camps in Iraq and Syria. Most recently, when Baghouz fell, about 5 boys from Sinjar were taken out, Yazidi boys. I don't think they could speak Kurmanji Kurdish anymore, but they said, oh, what happened to Sinjar? What happened to Sinjar? So they still kind of preserved some sense of their identity. At the cub camps, of which there were many, Yazidi boys weren't segregated. Yazidi, by that point, they were being converted, indoctrinated and converted. And so in one sense, the cub camps operated on a very general level, where Sunni boys and Yazidi boys who'd been captured kind of were put together and subjected to the same treatment in terms of beatings, being forced to watch executions, doing kind of mock suicide bombings, for example. But on another level, which really operated only against the Yazidi boys, the camps operated as a way of stripping them of their Yazidi identity. So they were taken, for example, and given Muslim names. They were indoctrinated quite heavily with in a way that the Sunni boys weren't exposed to. For the women and girls, a lot of them got out through fighters basically selling them back. Because to buy a woman costs maybe $200 to $1,500. You could sell the woman back to her family for $10,000 to $40,000, depending on how many children she had with her. And so actually this trade, because families had no help getting the women back, they were essentially buying them back from people who were abusing them. ISIS didn't allow it. ISIS didn't allow it. So we had instances where ISIS fighters who'd been found to sold Yazidi back to the community were executed by ISIS. But in the case of the boys, because they went off to the fighting ground, they never left ISIS, the organization. an ISIS organization would never have sold Yazidis back to their own community. That was not what they were trying to do. So it was very difficult to retrieve the boys that fought with ISIS. So I'm just going to say, this is the crime of genocide. It stems from the definition of the 1948 convention. It proved a very durable definition. It was replicated without any amendment in Article 6 of the Rome Statute. Genocide is committed when a person commits a prohibited act with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. I'm not going to go through, these are the protected groups, which is pretty straightforward. The Yazidis are often referred to an ethno-religious group. Again, I can speak a bit more about that in the questions. At the moment, the Yazidis of Sinjar don't necessarily view themselves as ethnically Kurdish anymore. That's a change in response to what they see as the betrayal of the Peshmerga. It's quite similar, in fact, to the Armenian Yazidis, who also don't view themselves as Kurdish, in response actually to the behavior of the Kurds, the fact that Kurds were part of the perpetrator group in the Armenian genocide, which also targeted the Yazidi community. But in the case of this particular instances, we term them a religious group because ISIS made massive statements about why they were attacking them. So these are the five genocidal acts. I'm not going to go through them. We can discuss them and again in more detail in the questions. Going to leave you enough time for questions. But it's just noticeable in the Prohibited Act that there is no mention of sexual violence. There's very little in relation to gender-sensitive approaches. So a lot of what has been read as a gendered interpretation of the Prohibited Act actually came quite late from the 1998 Akeisu judgment, where they read in sexual rape and other forms of sexual violence into causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. And so we've really tried, I think, a lot of people can think of genocide as being essentially an extermination, that genocide in the public imagination is about mass killing, organized mass killing, steeped in images of the Holocaust, or more recently Rwanda. I think it's really important to say that genocide operates with a number of different strategies, and that often killing members of the group, although it is the privileged genocidal act, does tend to be the act which is most likely to be committed against men and older boys during genocide rather than women and girls. Even when women and girls are killed in genocides, which happens often in root and branch genocides, for example, like Rwanda, you also see women and girls being killed in different ways than, for example, men and boys. So in Myanmar at the moment, with the Rohingya, which is seen as a potential ongoing genocide, we saw like men tending to be burned in houses or shot, but with women, you saw many more killings which were post-rape, or where they used implements that you would normally use to kill animals being used to kill women, for example. So this is so intent. So this is when we come down to, why is ISIS killing these Yazidis? We know they kill a lot of people. In fact, the majority of people that they've killed are Sunnis, who don't agree with them. And they have also killed a range of other different minorities. There have been some examples from, for example, the Christian community in Iraq. But why then do we say that the Yazidis are a little bit different? That's not to say that genocide is a more serious crime than crimes against humanity or war crimes. It's not. We don't go with the theory that there's a hierarchy of crimes. But yet what makes genocide different is not what the person does. It's actually why they do it. And for me, I think genocide in some ways is the most philosophical of any crime, because you have to have a structure of a motivation of what you're trying to achieve. And often what the genocidal groups are trying to achieve, or genocidal states are trying to achieve, is this idea of purity, that they have this idea of real or imagined former glory that they're constantly trying to get back to. So for Hitler, it was the Weimar Republic. For the Interahamwe, it was this idea of Hutu power. For Milosevic, it was this idea of Greater Serbia. And for ISIS, it's both kind of a near far. It's this idea of when 7th century in Islam, but it's also this idea of when the Sunni community was on top. So you have this idea of purification, and that therefore you have to do this thing in order to purify the community, even if you don't necessarily want to. And that message of purifying, it relies on some sort of a level of indoctrination within the community anyway. I don't mean necessarily religious indoctrination. I mean the community has got to be willing to accept, even if incrementally, higher and higher levels of violence towards certain members of in their midst. If you other people enough, it doesn't matter if everyone doesn't join in. What matters is no one steps up to stop it. And that's kind of the purpose of that kind of indoctrination. Oh, this is on. Okay. So we're almost finished. Most of the questions. I'm just going to just take you some of the ISIS publications. ISIS, as I mentioned at the beginning, is not a group that attempts to reframe what it's trying to do. It's actually kind of proud of what it's doing because it sees it as being right. That means for this particular case, it's actually much easier to determine what they are doing because they're not using any other cloaks. They're not using often the cloak of war to justify particular criminal acts. As you'll see. So they published this, they had a magazine article, they had a magazine called Dabak, was then later called Rumaya when they lost Dabak. Dabak has a very important kind of role. It's supposed to be where they defeat the armies of the Crusaders in the story. So they called the magazine Dabak, and this came from September 2014 when it was published, so shortly after the attack. And describes unconquering the region of Sinjar and Nineveh, the Islamic State faced a population of Yazidis, a pagan minority existent for ages. Their continued existence to this day is a matter Muslims should question, as they will be asked about it on Judgment Day. Their creed is so deviant from the truth that even cross-worshipping Christians for ages considered them devil worshippers and Satanists. So you see a lot of this. The article actually goes on for quite a long time. I'm just taking a clip of the front page of the article. And the article essentially goes on to discuss why they enslaved these women and why it was right to enslave these women, and that they spent a lot of time dividing people into different groups. So you have the believers, who are follow ISIS. Then you have the general category of kuffar, who are the disbelievers. But between that, you also have the mushrikeen, who are the polytheists, versus murtad, who are apostates. So Shias, for example, Shias in general are seen as apostates because they have taken in Islam and then rejected the true path of Islam. Whereas Yazidis, they see as never having had the opportunity to take Islam into their lives, and they continue in this time of, they're from the age of ignorance, the time of ignorance pre-Islam, and that they are essentially polytheists and idol worshippers. And for that, there are different ways of treating murtad versus mushrikeen. And the idea of taking women as slaves comes from their thing. So there's a bunch of internal ISIS documents. They actually were very paper heavy as an organization, even though they actually did have not a bad environmental policy, I should say. Strange enough, as many of the armed groups have gotten into the kind of climate change, Al-Shabaab has banned plastic bags from its region. But anyway, ISIS has a huge number of internal documents. I'll say this is one of the ones that we translated from the Homs unit from June 2015. This is the announcement of the slave market. You can see again the level of bureaucracy that is involved. The brothers who desire to buy slaves must register their names to the admiral official. Whoever does not register his name has no right to attend the slave trade market. The bid is to be submitted in a sealed envelope at time and purpose, and the one who wins the bid is obliged to purchase. So again, there's a lot of humanity stripped out of it, but it's also for the benefits of the fighters. In ISIS, if you don't believe in what ISIS is doing, you are immediately apostatizing yourself and therefore subject to death. So it's also saying if you say that this is wrong, you are leaving Islam, you are rejecting the true Islam, and therefore you yourself are subject to punishment. So very good ways of ensuring compliance within ISIS. The other thing I'm going to end on is just a note about the voices of Yazidi women. If you know about the Yazidis, it's probably because you've seen a woman who's a Yazidi survivor speaking about it. What we've seen is that because women suffer crimes in different ways, they tend to be more likely to survive. They suffer a larger range of crimes committed over a much longer span of time than men. Men generally either escape quite early on, or they are killed, usually. In the Yazidis, that's been true in a lot of other places. But in genocidal attacks, that tends to be true, because there isn't that emphasis, for example, on torturing people for information and so on. Yazidis women outside of Sinjar town generally were left school at age 13 to 15. They got married quite early on. They started to have children early on. I remember speaking to one woman who was 22 years old. She had three children under the age of six, and 22 members, male members of her family, were dead or missing. And so you have this question of, if you have this situation where women, they're already in a marginalized group across the board. If you're a female in that group, You're not generally not well educated. You've probably never been employed outside the family. The Yazidi community's ethos does not support female independence because for a Yazidi child to be Yazidi, both parents have to be Yazidi. And so the idea of Yazidi women going to university, working in places where they're going to come into contact with non-Yazidi men, it's something that is an existential threat to the community. And so you have the situation where you have now women who've never have no financial social independence, and the layer of men through which they have communicated with the world their entire lives is now gone. So it's a huge problem in terms of how you support these women who are also then face a tremendous amount of trauma and are managing a tremendous amount of trauma inside their households with their children. When we've seen women, they become the face and voice of the attacks on the Yazidis, but we haven't seen women being given the same role in discussions around what does justice mean for the Yazidis, what is the future of Sinjar, what transitional justice mechanisms do we need, what kind of protection do you want? So in the kind of conversations actually around substantive policy initiatives for the Yazidi community, what humanitarian goals need to be met when it comes to the Yazidi community, those meetings are very rarely have any women in them. So there has been this continual instrumentalization of the Yazidi female voices and Yazidi female persons without actually giving them any real increase in power. That has been seen increasingly now when we get into discussions around what happens to the children born of genocidal rape. It's become a tremendous issue, and I'm willing to take more questions on that. The Yazidi Spiritual Council, which is five men, initially released one document suggesting that they might be willing to accept the children in the same way that they accepted the women who'd returned. It was quite a big deal for the women to be accepted because ISIS was working on the suggestion that even if the Yazidi women happened to escape, they would be killed by their own community and they would not be considered Yazidi anymore because they'd had sexual contact with a non-Yazidi man. The Yazidi community kind of foiled that in a way that I think was progressive and actually quite surprising, in that they were really aware that this was an attack on the group rather than on the individual. And they took the stance of no shame that should attach to the individual, which is quite tremendous in a community where women's kind of sexual purity is linked to the honor of the community, which is why ISIS has chose this particularly destructive way to attack them. But they basically said, no, you ought to embrace these people, these women. And they create the ceremony at Lalish to welcome the women back into Yazidism and to make them part of the community. It's also meant for accountability purposes. It's being quite useful because you can actually get women to speak about what happened to them because the social cost of speaking out is very low for Yazidi women in comparison, for example, to Turkmen Shia women in Tal Afar, where we know that there are serious signs of high-level sexual violence, including sexual enslavement, but they will not come forward to speak because the social cost is so high. So for the children born of rape, the Spiritual Council then kind of backtracked under pressure from members of the community, and now there's this big question mark about what happens to the children that were born of all the genocidal rapes. At the moment, the community doesn't accept them, so some women have been forced to give up their children, some women have been forced to leave the community to raise their children alone, but either way, it's just now a further victimization in some ways of the women who suffered the rapes in the first place. So that's my question. I will probably leave the discussion of accountability for the Q&A because I want to leave a little bit of time for it. Thanks. So if you have any questions, let me know and I can continue.